They got to the Imperial Tower Hotel, at the corner of Yonge and Wood Streets, at a little past 3, by which point, between the hour and the food, they were all, except Dorothy, of course, feeling a bit worn down. There was a moment of confusion at the front desk, when the desk clerk, noting that Utena was speaking for Caitlin Stutter, assumed Utena was the companion robot listed on their reservation, and complimented Kate on her realism. But once that was straightened out, they found their way to their rooms on the 27th floor without further difficulty. The girls took room 2716, on the south side of the tower. Miki and Sionji thus ended up in room 2715, across the hall on the north side. They said their goodnights in the hall, making plans to sleep in. It was Sunday, after all. Even in the early 25th century, Canada was largely closed on Sundays. And let day one sort itself out organically once they were all up. Dorothy put her suitcase down next to the tall, dark-stained cabinet which held the television, then surveyed the large, comfortable room. It was furnished all in the same dark wood. 2 queen beds, a brown leather sofa, a desk and swivel chair, the television cabinet, a bureau, a nightstand, and a small table with a couple of dining chairs. The window in the far wall was actually a sliding glass door that led out onto a little concrete balcony with a view of Yonge Street, stretching southward past the clutch of towers that hid the lake from view. "Swanky," said Utena as she dropped her bag next to Dorothy's. "Do I want to know what this is costing?" "Not that much, actually," said Kate. "They just opened last month. They're still running introductory rates to try and draw business. February isn't exactly tourist season around here." "Oh, what was here before?" "A different hotel." "Ah." "I'll take the couch," said Dorothy. "Would they bring another pillow and blanket if we called the desk and asked?" Utena looked queryingly at Kate, who smiled and shrugged as she went into the bathroom to unpack her toiletries and change for the night. "That's okay, Dorothy," Utena said. "You can take one of the beds. Kate and I can share the other." Dorothy gave her a mildly puzzled look. "Are you sure?" she inquired. "I don't need to sleep at all. I only do it because I've..." She paused, as if searching her vocabulary. "I've come to enjoy it," she went on after a moment. "Yeah, it's okay," Utena repeated, then grinned. "We don't want to disrupt your experiment, after all." "All right," said Dorothy. "Thank you." Sunday was a low-structure day. They awoke at their own paces and fulfilled the usual duties of the first day in a hotel, unpacking their things, finding the soda machines, bitching about the exorbitant prices, filling the ice buckets. Then Sionji and Miki carried the chairs from their room's little table across the hall, and the five of them assembled around the table in 2716. Here, with a pile of guidebooks, the complimentary magazine from the desk, lunch from room service, and a copy of the Sunday Globe and Mail, they set out to plan, in broad strokes, their week in Hogtown. "Hogtown?" Sionji blurted. "What kind of a nickname for a city is Hogtown?" "Authorities are divided on the true etymology of the nickname," Dorothy began, "but..."
"Dorothy, come on. Vacation, remember?"
"Of course. Sorry." With that accomplished, they went out just to walk around the downtown area and get a feel for the city. It was a nice day, sunny and brisk, more like fall than late winter. The four duelists and friend chatted about this and that, walking aimlessly up and down the streets of Toronto in the early afternoon. Presently, their course brought them to the Bata Shoe Museum. Sionji and Miki were just as amazed as Amanda Dessler had been that there was such a thing as a museum dedicated to shoes, but neither was as skeptical as the Gamelon had been. "Well," Utena observed, "they're open for another couple of hours. Why not?" "Why not indeed?" The Bata Shoe Museum received its second and third visitors from Sephiro, and they were duly impressed. Emerging from the museum at its 5 p.m. closing into a rapidly gathering evening, the five resumed their tramp. As they explored Toronto's rather quiet Sunday night streets, Sionji developed a fondness for the city's mascots. Toronto is populated by hundreds of concrete moose, which stand on street corners and in front of buildings like serving sentinels, large, friendly, and often imaginatively, sometimes garishly, painted. They first appeared in the late 20th century, ostensibly for a temporary art exhibition, and have never gone. Sionji didn't know that. He only knew that they were the funniest, most charming civic quirks he'd ever seen, and he simply had to have pictures of them. The walk thus became a hunt, as he borrowed Caitlin's digital camera and led the five hither and yon in search of shots of the ultimate moose. Eventually, the hunt carried them down to the lakefront. Here, Utena and Caitlin pointed out the Raider Dome, reliving the high points of the World Series game they'd seen there the previous year. Not that their friends hadn't heard all the war stories before. "Hey, you know," said Utena, pointing to the dome's nearest neighbor, "we never did go up the tower."
No, we never did," Kate mused.
"Well, let's correct that. I'm hungry anyway." Response to that statement made it clear that hunger was in fact a common problem across the group. Well, except for Dorothy. Plus, the tower had a moose. It could be clearly seen from across the Raider Dome Plaza. So they would have had to go over there near it anyway, and so... A man of wisdom once said, "Never eat at a restaurant on the top of a building. If you must do so, at least make certain it does not revolve." The restaurant at the top of the CN Tower in Toronto is called 360. You can work out for yourself what that means it must do. Nevertheless, the food was good and the view spectacular. It was another beautiful night, sparkling clear, and though the tower was no longer the city's tallest building, it was still a respectable height, providing a good vantage point from which to overlook the city and the lake, depending on the orientation of their table at any given moment. Sometimes air cars would pause by the windows so their occupants could wave to restaurant patrons before darting away. Utena found herself nostalgic for the airships of New Avalon. "Do you suppose we're higher than the dueling platform?" Sionji wondered as he looked down at Lake Ontario. Utena looked too, then shrugged. "I don't know. I never could see the ground from up there. There were always clouds in the way." "The guidebook says there are 1,769 stairs to the top of the tower," Mickey pointed out. "I wish I'd thought to count the ones leading to the platform."
"First time I had to climb up there, it felt like there were about a million," said Utena.
"Wait a minute. You mean to tell me you didn't time how long it took you to get to the top?" Mickey shook his head. "I was always too preoccupied."
"Huh. Sloppy."
"However," Mickey went on, consulting his watch, "it takes this restaurant almost exactly 72 minutes to complete a full revolution." Utena looked across the table at him, an odd look on her face. Then she burst out laughing. Mickey blinked at her.
"What?"
he asked.
Sionji gave him a wry smile.
"Say what you just said again," he told Mickey. "It takes this restaurant almost exactly 72 minutes to complete a full revolution," said Mickey.
"Oh.
I just had this image," Utena gasped, "of you two, and Juri, and Toga, having a council meeting in a revolving restaurant at the top of the bell tower."
"Wouldn't have been much stranger than some of the meetings we did have," Mickey mused. Sionji drew himself up and intoned impressively, "If a diner cannot lift the lid of his entree, he will die without ever eating dessert." Mickey didn't miss his cue. "We are the diner," said he. "The world is our entree. If we cannot lift the lid, we will die without ever eating dessert."
"Lift the world's lid," Sionji declared grandly. "For the revolution of the restaurant," the two former counselors said together, raising their water glasses in a toast.
Caitlin reached to prop her hysterically giggling roommate up from sliding out of her chair. People at neighboring tables turned to stare. Kate gave them non-hostile mind-your-own-business sorts of looks.
"Okay," she said to the three Sephirians, "you guys are officially punchy."
She glanced at her watch.
"Not even 11 yet."
She shook her head.
Sad.
"Remarkable," observed R. Dorothy dryly. Monday found them piling back into the Impala, whose Dorothy suggested name, much to Utena's dismay, looked like sticking, and headed out to the Ontario Science Center. Sionji was happy with the place from the moment they arrived. It had a moose. They spent most of the day there, exploring the various exhibits and hands-on experiments. In the robotics and machine intelligence section, Dorothy amused herself by trapping a Zavrensky tester in a logic loop, proving that he was a machine and she was human, and thus demonstrating why Zavrensky tests hadn't been used as part of the Turing board battery for over a century. Mickey and Sionji spent at least 10 minutes gleefully teleporting each other back and forth from one end of the matter transference and energy manipulation exhibit hall to the other, while Caitlin took her time reading the placards.
At lunchtime, they all sat down at a table in the museum's cafeteria-style pizza-pizza, trays of slices in hand, talking cheerfully about the half of the museum they'd seen so far. "The way you wrapped that logic tester guy up in his own argument was really cool, Dorothy," Utena observed. "Indeed," said Kate, nodding, as she covered her pizza slices liberally with what she thought was grated Parmesan cheese from a glass shaker. "I think you're ready for Turing." "Perhaps," Dorothy allowed, which was as close as she ever got to the topic. "At any rate, I... what's the matter?" Caitlin had just taken a bite of her first slice, and was now regarding it with an expression somewhere between surprise and disgust. Slowly, she chewed, swallowed, took a large drink of her Coke, and then said, "That is not cheese." Mickey gave her a quizzical look, picked up the shaker, and sniffed at it. Then he blinked in surprise and put it down. "Oh," he said. "Garlic powder?" asked Dorothy. Kate nodded. "I'll be right back, she said, got up, and went back to the line at the counter. Sionji watched her go, puzzled. "She is not going to eat it?" he asked. No, said Utena. The two slices were nearly white with powdered garlic, as if they'd been left out in a heavy snowfall. Kate was very fond of grated Parmesan. "Shame to let it go to waste," said Sionji, and he stole them. "Oh, ew," said Utena. "You're seriously going to eat that?" "Certainly," said Sionji around his first bite. "Garlic is good for you." He swallowed, then gave her a sardonic look. "I don't think you're in any position to criticize my eating habits, Tenjo," he added. "At least the stuff I eat tastes good," Utena pointed out. "I'll take that as a compliment to my grilling skills," said Sionji with mock smugness. "You're impossible," said Utena with a grin. "I try," said Sionji. "Good Lord, you're eating that?" said Kate as she returned with two more slices and a shaker she had been assured was really cheese. For the remainder of the Science Center visit, the rest of the group was scrupulously careful to remain upwind of Sionji. Mickey and Caitlin took a bit longer than the others to finish, since the last section of the museum was the Acoustics and Music Hall. All of the exhibits and experiments in this hall interested them both enormously. In particular, Mickey had never seen a theremin before, and was astounded by it. "A completely analog instrument," Mickey mused, waving his hands over the electrodes and listening with a broadening smile to the eerie howl that poured from the speaker. "This is fantastic!" Kate grinned. I know how to build them if you want one," she said. "Really?" asked Mickey. "Where'd you learn that?" "Corwin," she replied. The music and acoustics exhibits held their interest until the place closed down around them, and they were forced to visit the gift shop and then hide themselves out. They found the other three in said shop, where they'd been browsing for nearly an hour. Sionji had a stuffed moose. Dorothy had a book on the evolution of machine intelligence testing and theory. Utena had a couple of Science Center t-shirts and a toy gyroscope. Mickey wondered, as he picked out a couple of t-shirts for himself, what a moose had to do with science. Sionji informed him that it wasn't the science part so much as the Ontario part. Slightly footsore, but in good spirits, the duelists and Dorothy returned to the Imperial Tower and kicked back for a while in room 2716, watching some random TV. Mickey admired the view from the room's balcony, which he said was more interesting than that to be had from the window, no balconies on the north side, of 2715. At 7, they went down to the subway and rode it south to BCE Place for dinner at the Marché Mövenpick, a favorite of Utena's since her first visit to the city the previous year. And what a pity Worcester didn't have one, but then Worcester didn't have much of anything when you got right down to it. Too bad we didn't think to come earlier, Utena, said Caitlin as she perused the selection of breads in one section of the vast mock marketplace restaurant. We could have had another game of bubble hockey at the Hall of Fame. Oh, yeah, said Utena. That is in this building, isn't it? What, pray tell? Sionji wondered as he proffered his bill to the keeper of the meats counter for stamping. Is hockey. The meat counter operative, though he hadn't been the one addressed, goggled nonetheless. You don't know what hockey is? He asked, incredulous. I'm from out of town, said Sionji dryly. I guess so, said the meats man. Once they'd all assembled their dinners and repaired to a table out in the mall's inner court, Caitlin tried to explain ice hockey. She'd already learned that such a game didn't exist in Sephiroth. It was her second favorite sport after baseball, and when she'd watched it on TV a few times over the course of the winter, Utena had been as puzzled by it as Sionji was now. I'm not really conveying it well, she said at length, feeling a bit frustrated. The best thing would be for you to go to a game. So let's, said Utena. I've always wondered if there wasn't something I was missing, trying to figure it out on TV. Kate nodded. There is, she agreed. But I don't think we'll be able to get tickets. The Leafs are the hottest ticket in town. She frowned thoughtfully, as if something was nagging at her memory. Although, she said. What about Demetrios? Asked Utena. Kate snapped her fingers. Yes, she declared. That's what I was trying to think of. Demetrios Arbuthnot, Utena explained to a puzzled-looking Miki. He runs a club Kate's band played the last time we were in town. The upstairs room of the place is full of Maple Leaf stuff. He's a huge fan. She gave Kate a speculative look. Figure he has season tickets? He might, Kate allowed. I guess we could ask him. For some reason, the day's activities had put Caitlin in a slightly odd mood. With their postprandial course of action decided, she spent the rest of the meal girl-watching, an activity for which the BCE Place Courtyard, and indeed the city of Toronto as a whole, is a place admirably suited. Shortly, she'd involved Miki, with slight embarrassment, and Sayanji, with feigned amusement at Miki's embarrassment, as well. Utena supposed she could have countered by trying to interest Dorothy in a spot of guy-watching, but such a scheme didn't seem likely to be profitable, so she didn't bother. Well, actually, Kate was doing a bit of that too, but she wasn't commenting about that so much, since she figured in doing so she'd lose her collaborators. Suddenly, a thought occurred to her. She looked at the date window on her watch, smiled, and cleared her throat, breaking into the conversation. "Excuse me, everybody," she said, "but I want to propose a toast." Kate tore her attention away from the tall redhead waiting for the elevator, turned, and gave her roommate a curious look. So did everyone else. Well, all right, Dorothy didn't look all that curious. Utena raised her water glass with a soft-eyed, sentimental smile, and said, "To Anthemia, may she be safe and well, and may we all see her again before this day comes again. Today is her birthday." Her fellow Sephirians and Caitlin all smiled that same slightly sad smile, all raised their glasses. Dorothy raised hers as well, her face unreadable. There was a tinkling sound as the glasses tapped together, and the others murmured, "To Anthe." Utena drained her water, put down the glass, and closed her eyes, smiling still, taking a moment with her thoughts. "Happy birthday, Anthe, wherever you are. Good luck. Be careful. Keep fighting. I love you." The ring on her third right finger tingled briefly. She opened her eyes and glanced at it in surprise, but it had fallen silent again, and gleamed back uninformatively to her puzzled gaze. She shrugged, wiped her misty eyes on her napkin, and grinned across the table at Caitlin, who smiled, then tapped Miki on the shoulder, and discreetly pointed out a gaggle of raver-style high schoolers just entering the court from the far end. Utena snickered, shook her head in mock dismay, and returned her attention to her steak sandwich.
"But certainly," said Demetrios, his grin threatening to dislodge his handlebar mustache. "I don't myself. Got to hang around this place most nights. But my brother-in-law does."
Kate's face fell. "Oh. Well, we don't want to bother." Demetrios gave a dismissive wave.
"Bah," he said. "He can stand to miss a game. Athena will be glad to stay home for a change on a Friday night. You wait right there."
He went to the telephone behind the bar, picked it up, and dialed.
"Feeny, it's Dimmy. Is Jack at home?"
Miki turned to Utena and mouthed silently, "Dimmy?" Utena shrugged. Dorothy looked around the room, about half full of college students. Some of them had books out and were reading or working on homework along with their buffalo wings. No band tonight, so the empty stage was darkened and the PA system played recorded rock music, not too loud to talk over. The room was, as Utena had said, jammed with Toronto Maple Leafs paraphernalia, Hockey sticks, posters, framed jerseys, signed photographs of players, ticket stubs, all manner of Leafs-related things covered the walls. A young man with sandy hair and a Toronto University sweatshirt slid onto the stool next to her while she was reading the fine print on a replica of the Stanley Cup, which stood on a shelf behind the bar, surrounded by bottles of various types of booze. It took Dorothy a few moments to realize that he was staring at her. That struck her as rather odd, as did his choice of seat, since the bar was only about half populated. She unzoomed her optics and turned her head to face him. "Yes?" she asked. "Hi," he said. "I'm Jeff." "Congratulations," Dorothy replied. He chuckled self-deprecatingly, running a hand over his rather bushy hair. "Don't be that way," he said. "Can I buy you a drink?" "No," said Dorothy. "I'm not staying long." "What a shame," said Jeff. "What's your name?" "Dorothy," she said unencouragingly. Cyanji, seated on the other side of the robot girl, noticed the little tableau playing out to his right and started paying attention. "Well, Dorothy," said Jeff pleasantly, "I think you're being just a little too hasty to judge poor old Jeff. Why don't you come over to my table and we'll talk about it?" Dorothy regarded him unblinkingly for several seconds. "I don't think so," she said. Jeff frowned. "What's the matter?" he inquired, his voice a trifle plaintive. "Is it my breath? My haircut? Don't you like college guys? I could drop out," he offered with a wry grin. Cyanji stood up and turned to face him, looming over the still-seated Dorothy in the process. Though probably 3 years younger than Jeff, Cyanji was considerably taller, and outdid the university student in shoulder breadth as well. "Get lost," he said. Jeff raised his hands in surrender, still smiling. "Okay, okay," he said. "Sorry, misread the situation. No need to get mad." He turned the smile on Dorothy for one last attempt. "See you around, Dorothy." "Unlikely," said Dorothy, turning back to her contemplation of the Stanley Cup. "Pushy bastard," Cyanji muttered at Jeff's retreating back. He slid back into his seat. "What was that all about?" Utna wondered, having caught only Cyanji's standing and sitting again. "Nothing," Cyanji said. "Some idiot trying to pick up Dorothy." "I wanted to see how long he would persist in the face of total indifference," Dorothy observed. "But thank you all the same, Cyanji." "Okay," said Demetrios, who was blissfully unaware of the entire incident, as he put down the phone and turned to face Kate again. "It's all set. He's going to bring his tickets for Friday's game over here in the morning. You can pick them up any time. There's just one problem," he added with an apologetic look. "Now that his son's been born, he's only got two. Theny doesn't let him go out with the boys like she used to anymore."
"Oh, well..."
Kate turned to Utna.
"Why don't you and Cyanji go? Sending him to a game is the point of the exercise, and you wanted to see one in person."
"Tell you what," said Demetrios. "Why don't the rest of you come here Friday night? I've got a pretty good band lined up first thing. A little too modern for my taste, if you know what I mean, but you might find them interesting. Called themselves The Crush of Love."
Kate brightened. I've heard of them," she said. Lots of guitars, kind of experimental.
Demetrios waited patiently for her to struggle through the last word, then nodded. "That's them. Leader's a kid named Joe. Goes to the university. Nice kid." Kate turned to Mickey. "Sound good to you?" Mickey nodded. "I'm always interested in new musical experiences," he said.
Dorothy?
"The crowd here is a little pushy," Dorothy deadpanned. "Don't worry about that," said Demetrios. "Anybody gives you trouble, you come tell me and I'll give him trouble." Dorothy nodded. "Fair enough."
What do I owe you?
Asked Kate. But Demetrios made that expressive, dismissive wave again. "Jack can afford to give him away," he said. "More money than sense, that boy has."
Kate blinked. "I have to give you something," she protested.
"Well, I'll tell you what. You bring your band back here some weekend before school lets out, and you all scatter for the summer, and we'll call it even, okay?" Caitlin turned to Mickey, and for a moment the two highest officers of the WPI Student Orchestra conferred. The spring concert was on April 22nd, final rehearsals beginning on the 16th. The Art of Noise had another show at the WAG on the 9th. They worked backward, finally arriving at the optimum date of Saturday, March 26th, 3.5 weeks hence. Have to clear it with our manager, said Kate, but... Good enough, said Demetrios. If something comes up, we'll reschedule. Like I told the pretty lady who sells your shirts, he added with a grin at Utena, I wish I could have you in here every week. He bobbed his bushy eyebrows at Kate and continued, Ever consider Toronto University after you graduate from the Institute? Kate laughed and told him she'd think about it, and the fivesome took their leave. Nice guy, Sionji grunted as they left Sneaky D's and started walking back down college toward their hotel. Needs to screen his clientele a little better, though. You overreacted, said Mickey. I mean, can you really blame him? Miss Dorothy is quite lovely. Everyone stopped walking and looked at him, even Dorothy, who looked as if she entirely did not know how to take that. What? He inquired innocently.